sit back and get ready to take off with Dynamic Golf. Golf listeners, with me today is my fellow co-host Sean Klotz. I am T-Mac, better known as Tim McElvanna. Sean, I thought it'd be a great way to kind of turn the dime a little bit and interview you today. So tell us a little bit about yourself before we begin, because I've got some really good questions for you today.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, definitely, you know, hello to our listeners, T-Mac. I'm excited about some of the traction we're doing with some of the podcasts. We've been getting some good feedback up here in the Oakley, Boston, Watertown area.
Yeah.
I know some people are listening down in Florida still too, which is great. It's funny, T-Mac, because I've been trying to get ready for this the last couple of days. This might be my most nervous one because, yeah, like, you know, talking about yourself and sort of explaining what you do and what, you know, how you get there. But no, I just thought it'd be a good way to sort of, you know, my life story, your life story, T-Mac, kind of like our friends that are in the golf industry. It's going to be sort of emblematic of what happens when you get into the golf industry. So even though we might be talking about some personal things, all of the golf pro brethren and sisterhood that we have, the friends that get into this business, mm-hmm, no matter what part of the business, I think it's, we just have challenges because we don't work 9 to 5, right? That's not our 40-hour 9 to 5 deal.
Correct. Yep.
And your kids are, how old are they now? Like 6 and 4 or something?
I've got a 5 and a 2-year-old. So it's, you know what it's like. It's tough to have a home life and, you know, run leagues or run things in the evening time when most golfers want to golf. So it's tough on the home life for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. When we worked together at Silverado, you know, we would just kind of divvy up the leagues. You got 3 nights of leagues, and mm-hmm, that's you're getting home around 10 or 11 o'clock at night. It's challenging on the family life. It really is. It becomes a, you know, it's unfortunately, I mean, might as well just start off there. Like I, you know, got divorced in 2023, kind of separated in 2021. Like, I don't want to make it too, you know, dramatic, but yeah, it's a cause and effect part of the relationship of marriage. When you are in this industry, your hours, like we said, we're not 9 to 5 people. We're very rarely home on weekends. Yeah. Right.
Usually never home on the weekends, never home on holidays. Never. Right. I mean, those are the days that are busy days. Right. So,
yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's another good point, T-Mac, like vacation, like summer, people go on summer vacation. Well, we can in Florida, we can kind of take that 1 or 2 week break in the summer, but you know, there's no December Christmas vacation because you're working, because there's more people there.
Correct.
Is the July 4th. What do? We run a flag day tournament for the people that want to get to the golf course. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving's tricky. Sometimes you do like a Turkey Day shootout, or, you know, you still got to go in the morning because there's still people playing golf in the morning. So yeah, as I prepared for this, it was definitely a cause of the divorce, that I'm just being flat out honest with people.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it is too, and you're starting to see this already with your girls, it affects your relationship with your kids too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that's why I kind of went into the instruction side of it and shied away from being head pro, general manager, assistant pro. One, I don't think that fits me very well, but two, being an instructor, I was able to kind of make my own hours, do my own thing. And that's huge when you have little ones. And I'm sure that was extremely tough for you. You went through so many golf courses, and we're going to touch on that as well. They're expecting you to be there, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like Scott said, once you walk through the door, people don't want to hear it. They want to know that you're there to serve them.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to be on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's start with that. When you walk out of your car, you're on. There's no foul mood. I love Scott's story about how he told the, you know, he actually told a member what he was really feeling when he was going through one of his days. And then his boss, his director of golf, kind of pulled him aside and said, "Hey, they don't care."
Yeah.
They don't care. Like, you know, it's not the members don't care. It's just that, again, our job is to kind of create the experience for them, whether you're at a public or a private facility. You're just trying to, you know, allow them to get away from their lives for 4 to 5 hours. So you're always on.
Correct.
You, EMAC, the other part of this thing too is as I was prepared for this, we have to be 100% knowledgeable with no fallacies. Like we can't, when somebody comes to us for a ruling, we have to know it
Yeah.
or be able to have access to it. So our judgment, you can't like show favoritism for one member or one golfer or one person versus another. Employees, same thing, right? You to run 35 staff members, you have to be the decision maker. You got to be part friend, part, manager, part kind of confidant. Like there's so many roles that we have throughout the day. And I'm not whining when I talk about this stuff, T-Mac. I'm not whining. It's really what I love because I love the diversity of the job. But it does weigh on you. And when you get back in the car and go home, that decompression time is invaluable to get so you don't bring it home.
Absolutely. You've got to have an outlet. For most of us, it's playing golf, right? Getting on out there and playing a little bit, getting that stress reliever on out there. It's something that you've got to find your way to kind of relax and decompress. And also, you've got to manage to find time to spend with your family and do the things that they want to do as well. Not everybody's as interested in golf and everybody's family as we are. I'm coming to find that out real quick. So there's other things that we have to do, and it's a juggling act. And my hat's off to people like your general manager Scott Johnson or your head pro Scott Johnson, who's able to juggle all these balls in the air and has a smile on his face when he talks to your members or clients. I mean, that's huge. I mean, I don't, that's big time. That's all-star kind of stuff. And I don't think it can be said enough.
No, that's what we've done. I've been a so maybe going to the history part of it a little bit. Like I became a PGA member in 2003. So now over 20 years of being a PGA member, we don't have to go back to the cradle, but basically, started playing golf when I was 13 years old. Dad was a huge influence in that. I'll talk about him a little bit more, but
Right.
my uncle Jimmy was a huge influence. My mom's brother, he was a better golfer than my dad, so he kind of was the one who maybe kind of gave me the instructions at the beginning. Gave me the first set of old Hogan Apexes, right? The old heavy stuff we would never let our juniors hit now.
Oh, yeah. It'd be a John Daly swing for those kids then.
Wilson staff, Persimmon driver, which was smaller than any 3-wood that's on the market currently. So he, Jimmy was the one who kind of got me going. My dad was the one who would drop me off every morning, pick me up every night. Mom would have the food ready for you, like the kind of the classic American sort of like upbringing. My brother was 5 years older, so I tagged along with him, whether he liked it a lot or not, or whether he liked it or not, to everything, every sporting event, with baseball, basketball, golf, were the three main. And that's, in the full circle of life, that's how I met Scott Johnson, which is the ironic part of me being up here in Boston now. But 13 years old playing and kind of having making that decision between golf and baseball, and I've said it before, like I wanted all the glory. I no, like I just got frustrated pitching and having kids making errors, and I may not have been the best pitcher ever, but at least, we could kind of get the ball in the strike zone and with some speed and a little curve. But I just saw that happen early from 10 to 13. I'm like, uh-oh, I need to find something where
It was
I can
always
have
that
all the
kid in
glory.
right field that couldn't catch the ball. You know what I mean? It drove me nuts. I know what you're saying. I mean, is that about the time that you started at that age starting to think maybe I can turn this what I love this into a profession? Did you think maybe at this age, instead of being a professional baseball player, maybe being a professional golfer might be an avenue for you? Did you think about that at this age, or was that a little bit later on down the road?
I think it was more of the college experience. So high school, up here in Massachusetts, went to Peabody High School. Kind of a good state player, we'll call it. Kind of went to states as an individual. And you realize even at that point, you're like, okay, there's a difference between me, maybe the top 20 in the state versus the top 5 in the state. Like those kids are going to Florida, Texas, Duke, those kids are good. But it was good enough to get to go to University of Tampa. Play college golf. I mean, part of that story is I went my freshman year and I didn't make the team, and I probably didn't deserve to make the team. I was kind of 13th out of 12, and I was not happy with it at the time, but I'm now 1500 miles away from my home and in college, and what am I doing type of thing.
Yeah.
So it's one of those checkpoint moments in your life where you say, okay, well, either you get better or you give it up and do something else. And came back, worked hard during my freshman year up here in Massachusetts, and literally went to see Scott Johnson as when he was at Tedesco, and got lessons from him when I was, 18, 19.
Oh, well.
He would have been 24, 25, and worked at it hard that summer, came back, and he went to University of Tampa and literally made the team. This is a good life lesson. Made the team my sophomore year, but I wasn't picked. I was 7th out of 12. But there was kids that had been promised scholarships who got the positions instead of me. And I mean, that was another huge, like, gut body blow type of thing. Like, what now? What are you doing?
Yeah.
Now you're 2 years into your college career, and you're still not playing. I'm playing every day in Florida and Tampa, and you're again, it was the best place to be.
Oh.
And it was good that you didn't go home and sulk or whatever. You just kept trying to get better.
And did you, I mean, I'm sure you've seen your scoring average probably went down tremendously in that 2 year period right there. And what were some of the things at that point that you're really trying to focus on? Was it more the short game, or was it more the golf swing itself, you think?
So, like, our least favorite term when somebody comes to us for a golf lesson is they want to be more consistent, right? I was trying to learn how to score. So I could shoot 76, but I could shoot 82 at the same point. And the sort of rhyme or reason, the mental part of it, the how do you keep it together when you do make a double? How do you make three or four birdies in a round to offset the one or two doubles? That's where I had to get to. So it was a little bit of a mental, yes, you're always working on physical things. And again, kind of working on golf swing, always chipping and putting. Loved still to this day, to this moment, one of my favorite, you mentioned it earlier, like therapies, is for me to put on headphones. Back in the day, they were like Walkman type of stuff. Listen to Spotify, listen to iHeartRadio, listen to our podcast, listen
Dynamic
to other
golf.
people's podcasts. Exactly, just a little plug. Listen to music and go chip for 3 hours and just love it. Just keep, and it's just about that being by yourself, working on your game, trying different things. I think there's a huge part of experimentation that we kind of forget when we're learning the game of golf. We're so adamant about the mechanics of it, we forget about the imagination part,
Correct, yes.
which, you hear Tiger talk all the time about. You hear Phil talk about all the time, like, there's a reason their short game is so amazing, because they were just trying shots and seeing what happened and did it, right? They weren't so by the book of ball has to be here, face has to be here, weight has to be here. You can do it different ways, and you can, groove anything. That's another thing to say, right? You can groove anything,
Yes.
good and bad. You
Even an
see a lot of
incorrect
bad.
motion, I was going to say, you can even groove that too, so.
So you're persistent. And again, kind of life lesson, like, okay, and you don't sometimes realize as you're going through it when you're 20, you're just more frustrated. Why am I not making this team when I just beat five kids, but somehow I'm not going to end up making the team. So you go back, you do your work again your sophomore year, you go see Scott Johnson again, keep working on stuff. And then by the time junior year, it's a little bit like when you see the, I think it's like those, the college athletes that go to a Duke or go to a Texas for basketball, like, they're not ready. They need more than 1 year of basketball, but they're lottery picks in the NBA, so they just throw them into the NBA and they're not ready yet. And that's
Yeah.
my, I wasn't ready yet. I needed to keep doing the work to get better, improve, and get the scores to be more 72, 74, 76, 72, 74, like, get in more of that consistency terminology rather than having the blow up holes. And coach sees an 82, he's not going to put you in because he knows in a tournament if you have that capability. But if he sees you consistently shooting between 72 and 76, okay, we trust this kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at that point, it comes down to, do you want to win, or is it just, putting your favorites out there? you know, especially
The
when you.
Olympic team, right?
What's
The
that?
basketball Olympic team up here in Boston, Jason Tatum not playing in the gold medal game or, in the basketball part of the Olympics was really not well received up here
Yeah.
because Coach Kerr, he's got confidence and trust in Curry and LeBron and Durant. So Tatum doesn't get in for two games.
Well,
Just one and not.
I was going to kind of point towards Zach Johnson a little bit with the Ryder Cup.
Oh, yeah.
I think part of being a coach is understanding and putting that pride aside and saying, listen, you know, I've got to put the best player out there. Just my little plug on that, though.
No, I think that's great. So anyways, got through 2 years at University of Tampa, played some college golf, really enjoyed it. The experience was great. Our team was not as good as it was when Scott was there, but we were very good. We just weren't like national championship worthy. But I'd say the number one guy probably shot between 70 and 73. The number six guy would probably be like a 76 or below.
Okay.
So it was a good group of kids, a good group of guys, and just that experience of playing golf every single day with good players makes you a better player. Period.
Just out of curiosity, what course did you guys, what was the home course for University of Tampa at the time, or is it
Yeah,
still?
Rogers Park,
Well,
Rogers Park, right? Municipal golf course in Tampa with a ton of history to it. But that's where we played, and then we actually played our tournaments at Wentworth, which was a new course at that time. Really difficult golf course, very challenging. I've talked about it before on the podcast, but one of the tournaments that we hosted at Wentworth, I shot 101-73 same day, and that's just
Wow.
it's the thing of if you're not hitting it good, how do you let the round get away from you? And mentally, and then also, how do you bring it back within a literally half an hour time span where you got to go back out there and figure out something to with duct tape and Elmer's glue or whatever to get your golf swing to work where you can get the ball around.
Absolutely, because you know you're mentally fragile at that time, and it's like, you know, anybody's ever told me you're one swing away from thinking you can win the Ryder Cup, and you're one swing away from wanting to quit the game, you know. So you're very mentally fragile after a round like that. You know you've got to go out there and perform again. It's tough, you know. And I think if I know you with all the gut checks that you had, it was a gut check, and you went out there and you proved your test, if I had to make a guess.
Yeah, you got to you change your you again definition of insanity type of stuff. You can't keep hitting driver on every hole. The course is narrow.
Yeah.
Let's hit a 3 wood or 5 wood off the tee. Let's get the ball in the center of the fairway. Very rarely do things happen poorly from the center of the fairway, right?
Right.
Let's almost hit it to the 150 marker. You know you're a good iron player from 150. Let's start hitting center greens. Let's stop putting so much pressure on your short game. Like it just kind of all snowballs.
Yeah.
And if you do it the correct way, so for the players of the people that are listening now, sometimes we hear about as we're in the shop, guy will go out and shoot 50, 38. Or sometimes it's the opposite where they get the round of the life going, shooting 36 in the front, and then they shoot 48 on the back because they start thinking about the process and forget about all the things that got them into
Absolutely.
the good rounds of golf. So it can work both ways, but
And wouldn't you
yeah,
say
so.
from the mental side of that, wouldn't it seem like, at least for me, it always seems like the game is being played at slower speed. Like when I'm playing bad, I feel like I'm playing it fast forward. And when I'm playing good and hitting fairways, hitting, you know, greens, it's a very boring kind of, you know, slow process. You know, everything's very there in front of me, but it seems like when I start playing bad, and maybe for you too, everything just feels like it's, you know, like you just got thrown into the NFL and you're the running back. You know what I mean?
It's quick, yeah. I mean, one of the hardest parts of our sport is that we're active in an 18-hole round for I think around 1 minute, 1 minute and 20 seconds is what we're active for because the golf swing is, 1.4, 1.6 seconds long. So during this 4 hour process or sometimes 5 hour process, how are we keeping our mind engaged? And I think Scottie Scheffler currently is the best at this in the world. Tiger at his peak was the best at it. Jack Nicklaus at his peak was the best at it. Like the guys who can compartmentalize, Scottie Scheffler got arrested on a Friday and he goes out and shoots 66 five under. Are you kidding me? He's in jail 4 hours before.
Yeah, that's mental fortitude right there, without a doubt. I mean, wow.
To me, that was the round of the year. People keep talking about some of the other, great rounds and part the last day of the Shoffley shooting the great round to win the British. Like, I mean, yes, there's great rounds. I just think that one stuck out to me as the golf pro guy. Like, how do you compartmentalize being in jail 2 hours before, and now you're going to go play a PGA Tour event? But and when what Scheffler said is, and you hear this a lot of times from athletes in general, once they get in between the lines, everything else goes away.
You know, they let their inner athlete, as you've said, just kind of take over, and they're on autopilot. You know, that slow feeling, everything's just kind of coming. There's not a lot of active thought. There's a lot of thought going on. It's just not a lot of active thought, right?
That's it. That's it.
So, as you moved through your golf career and moved into more of your professional career, how did you turn this kind of, hobby, this love for it, and how did you say, listen, I want to turn this into a passion where it's a career of mine?
I think so. Yeah, going back to like the college is when I started realizing maybe, okay, not good enough to play PGA Tour, but what else could I do with the game? So after college, my year after I got out, I went back to Tampa because I was definitely considering staying up in Massachusetts, and that's where I was from and whatever. And I met a teacher. His name is Billy London, and I've got like a list of just influential people in my life, and Billy's on there. It's funny, T-Mac, because again, I was thinking about this. Like, I remember these people, like Lyman Doan was a coach that I had, or a teacher at Thompson Country Club. I'm 13 years old. Bill Flynn is the owner, great PGA member. Lyman Doan is a teaching pro at the place. Rick Quinn was a assistant pro when I was like 16, 17. Dave Hart was an assistant pro when I was 16, 17. My point is, like, I don't know if I can remember my eighth grade teacher, but I can tell you the golf pros that have influenced the development of who I am and the things that I teach to this day. And they shouldn't be forgotten. Like, these guys are just mentors that they're just doing their daily work, which is what we do now in teaching every day, right?
Yeah, we've picked up the torch that they've handed us, right?
100%. So Billy London was the guy after University of Tampa, came down 23 years old, met him at Rocky Point. That's where I met him.
Okay,
Another
another public course, right?
it. I'm hitting balls that range at Rocky Point. You couldn't hit more than 6 iron. It was like a 180 length, maybe.
Okay.
And I'm hitting balls, and I mean, he sees me over there. He's teaching, whatever. He comes over to me one day. We start talking. Literally 13 years later, he's still my coach. So 36 years old, I've been with him. I was with him for 13 years. He charged me at the beginning, meaning the first year. After that, he never charged me for 12 years in a row. I would take him out to dinner or lunch or whatever. Help out with, he might need some gas money or whatever. And he was just a great guy, but he was trying to pay it forward because he had been taught by a guy named Johnny Farrell in New Jersey when Billy was 13, 15 years old. Johnny Farrell, like, I think the claim to fame is, I don't know if he won the US Open, but he was like a top pro in that Jersey, New York area. But if somebody Googles Johnny Farrell, they're going to find out that Johnny Farrell had an amazing career. And Johnny Farrell taught Billy London. And now I meet Billy London when he's like 60 years old, 55 years old. And now Billy London's teaching me when I'm 23. Like, the circle of life type of thing is amazing to me. So Billy teaches me. Billy
I
teaches
was
me
just
how
gonna
to.
say that, yeah, he won the 1928 US Open. So
Is that right? There you go.
yes, he
Perfect.
won the 1928 US Open, and he is a World Golf Hall of Famer. So he's just not some, hey, this is a pro down the road. This is that's pretty stout stuff. So go right
That's
ahead.
pretty
I'm sorry
crazy.
to interrupt, but I just had to
No,
Google
but
that, and I'm like, holy cow, that's a wonderful lineage to have.
it's just funny how the other part of this is that it doesn't change the techniques, the keep your hands in front of the ball at impact, like the make sure your weight shifts to your left side. That didn't change in the last now 100 years. We're going 28 to 24. I mean, it just gets passed down. It's, like, I don't want to get too much, like, it's not biblical, but Bible stuff was kind of taught from oral history down through the, you know what I'm saying? So
Oh,
this is the
yeah.
same type of stuff. Like, there wasn't YouTube in 1928. There wasn't podcasts in 1936. Like,
No.
it was taught through either books or just generation to generation. So Billy was an amazing impact on my career. And the way that I've told this before, the way that he taught me how to teach was he gave me a left-handed golf club and said, "Okay, I'm going to teach you." And I'm like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "You don't know anything. You don't know what you're doing left-handed. You know everything right-handed. So we need to teach you how to teach somebody from the perspective of they don't know which end of the club to hold.
Yeah.
They don't know which hand to put on top. They don't know which foot to put in front." Like, and that was a great lesson for me that I still use to this day. Like, you got to take that beginner golfer. I just had a beginner yesterday, brand new golfer guy, 35 years old, pretty athletic soccer player, one of the members, son-in-laws. And it's just funny teaching somebody from brand new. Okay, put your right-handed golfer. Okay, well, we're going to place your left hand on the club. And they look at you like, "What do you mean?" "Oh yeah, I got to back up. I got to show them which finger to start the shaft in so that
Yep.
they can put their left hand correctly on the club."
Yeah. I mean, you've got to get down to the basics of just putting the club right across the right knuckles and then closing fingers. I've gone to that and they're like, "What, you just don't grab the club like you would a baseball bat or anything
Baseball.
else, or a hockey
Yep.
stick?" I'm like, "No, there's a certain way." So you're absolutely right. You got to be fine-tuned.
So he was just such a good influence and taught me. You've seen me do this before too, like swinging one-handed, left-handed. Making contact with the ball, it really shows you to use your front side of your body, and your whole control of your swing should be with your lead arm, not your trail arm. And that's something, again, like I'm learning this when I'm 24, 25, after playing college golf, after having a one handicap for 5 years, learning this at this point, and it's helped me in my golf swing to this day now. He was just such a good, he got ornery in his old age, as we all do, type of thing, but and I would the and I'll say this to anybody who ever wants to get in this profession, one of the things I did the most was watch him teach others, right? We do
Absolutely.
I can go on a rant here, but we do such a poor job of assistant pros or PGA of America of how do you teach somebody how to teach?
Yes.
Right? Like, it's a learned art. It's something you have to do repetitively. You're a
Well,
better teacher than you were 2 years ago. You're a better teacher than you were when you worked with me 5 years ago because you've taught a lot in the last 2 years.
yes. Well, I think the and for a little plug for you is that and you come up to a good point. No, most of the assistants are stuck in there, but you would always find some time to either most of the time not Sean, because Sean was he was usually behind Tim Pulse, usually listen to him. But you were very kind and courteous with your time to take me on out there and say, "Hey, listen, I'm gonna give a lesson," or "I want you to observe me." And you did that for a good, 6 to 8 months when I first got there. You did a great job of paying it forward there too. So don't ever sell yourself short on that, partner.
No, but the difference, T-Mac, is you wanted to learn. That's the difference. Like, you were so curious about club repair. You taught yourself club repair. You want to learn how to become a better teacher. And we always said it, like, we don't know everything, but we can learn from each other. So I teach stuff that you've taught me, and you were teaching to other people, and then you teach stuff that I taught you, and I taught other people when you're watching.
Yeah.
That's how you become better at it. It really is. So no, it's and maybe to one of our ultimate points of this podcast, one of the reasons why I still am a golf pro is because of teaching. Like, that's probably one of the pinnacle, paramount type of things that I got into the game. I didn't know that maybe necessarily got into the game for, but as I got into the career part of it, the business side, okay, you're going to be the general manager, so you're in charge of the budget, profit and loss statements, reading a balance spreadsheet, managing people.
Yeah, those are all the things that golfers want to get into, right, Sean?
Golf cart, how do you golf cart fleet management, rules of golf, like
Exciting
when I went
stuff
to
right there.
Oh my gosh. When I went for level one PGA, they do it a little differently now. You got three levels still, but level one PGA, you walk into your first seminar and there is a board out front and it says PGA members are responsible for this. And there's 29 different things that the PGA member is responsible for. And it still is probably a small list. As like we talked about with Scott, my brother, who's a PGA member since he's got over 25 years in the game. Just our different friends, Keith Colzer, Jeff Leonard. They're on the ground. These are guys on the ground doing the work daily to promote the game.
Absolutely. I guess the big thing for me is that when I got into the PGA, I was like, why am I learning about fleet? How much space that the golf carts need when they're stored? I'm like, what is that going to help me with? But you realize that it all interconnects and it all kind of goes together. But you're right. I mean, the thing that gets us into this game is not spreadsheets, it's not rules. We do enjoy that, at a certain level, but the thing that we enjoy is watching somebody hit that ball for the first time and you see that shot go to their heart and they look at you like just bewilderment, like, oh my God, I can do this. And you're like, I'm done for the day. That is all I need. That is my high for the day. I am good. I could probably go into the counter and do 8 hours, and that would be tough for me.
I will say too that that part of what we do is, and you for maybe the younger listeners out there, the guys who want to get, and girls, but definitely please, the girls that want to get into the PGA program or whatever, you may not know. It's just like college. Like, you may not be able to declare your major, meaning you may not know exactly what you want to do when you get in the golf profession. But when you get in the golf profession, it's, don't limit yourself to the opportunities. I would never even knew what TrackMan was 3 years ago,
Yes,
right?
right.
I never even, I definitely had in my head, as Brant Lee, the owner of Silverado, unfortunately, as he got sick towards the end, I mean, we had always talked about trying to purchase that golf course. I had started putting together a buying group and literally made presentations to five different people to buy Apollo Beach Golf and Sea Club. Like, your career kind of morphs is the point. It doesn't stay stagnant with, okay, I'm just going to sit behind the counter and take money. It does if that's what you want it to be, but I really started getting into the idea of, like, I don't want to work for somebody else. I want to work for myself.
Correct.
And you embody that so much. I tried it for 4 years, and I'm not saying I won't get back into it in the very near future, but ultimately, we are, as PGA members, almost always, some exceptions, independent contractors. We typically don't work for a corporation. Yes, there are some, but ultimately, you still are the independent. Like, you're not a labor union person, even though we pay labor union dues for the PGA. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, I really started getting excited about the opportunity of buying my own golf course, getting in front of investors and saying, "Hey, look, here's the deal. We need 1.5 million. We got five people interested. That's $250,000 each. Here's the business plan. Here's the expected income. Here's the model. Are you interested in buying in?" And five people said yes. And we put together that proposal to buy Apollo Beach Golf and Sea Club down there in Tampa. It didn't work out because another bigger company came in and offered more money to Roger Penske, and they took that deal. And that happens sometimes too.
And that's Penske Motor Oil, correct?
Exactly. The trucking company and the racing company, Roger Penske. But even now, T-Mac, that deal still isn't done because the county, they put the kibosh on it because they're like, it's environmentally sensitive protective area. You can't build condos on top of it. You can keep it a golf course. So it currently stands closed, no business at all.
That's a
And
shame.
being, but it's like, okay, it's like, okay, that happened. So from there, then I decided, okay, let me try to open up a retail golf store with TrackMan in it, and with being able to sell golf clubs and do club repair. My kind of overall point is, like, don't be stagnant. Let your career keep morphing into whatever it is going to be.
Well, I think you brought up a really good point at the beginning of this conversation is that when you walked into the board, it says PGA professionals are responsible for these 29 different things. And I think you're absolutely right. Everybody goes into the idea of thinking, well, I'm going to work behind the counter and I'm just going to be the pro shop guy. or the general manager. But
Or
you
I'm going to go teach for 8 hours or whatever, right, whatever.
correct. But you come to realize that when you're in this industry, you're touching all aspects, and there's going to be ones that you really enjoy a lot more. And there's a lot of unique avenues, especially like with your business that you had down here in Tampa, the One Stop Golf Club in Brandon and in Zephyr Hills. You know, I'll let you talk about it, but I think that is going to be the wave of the future, what you're trying to do with that business plan. I think it's got great potential. So if you
I
touch on
think,
that,
I mean,
please.
yeah, definitely. I mean, the retail is hard. Retail's hard. Retail's hard, period, the end. Amazon made retail hard. eBay made retail hard. You're going to go get a better deal somewhere else. You're not going to get custom fit for your clubs. You're going to come back to us when you aren't correctly fit and your clubs aren't working, and then realize that maybe you should have just kind of invested $75 in a club fitting. But again, even when I was working with you at Silverado, like we didn't do club fitting. We didn't. That wasn't part of our deal. But as I decided to, okay, I'm gonna stop working for other people. I'm gonna try to work for myself. I've got a partner who's an amazing person who was the capital guy, the money guy, and basically said, look, I believe in you, which you need for the record. You need that in your personal life and professional life. You need somebody to believe in you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's
And
big.
right, yeah, and realize that you can do this. And I'm not disappointed that we didn't make it. Like, we lasted 3 years starting a small business. For the record, February 2020 was when we incorporated. We opened June of 2020. Didn't expect COVID to happen as you're developing these
Correct.
business models and plans,
Yeah.
right? You don't expect supply chain issues to be a problem for a year.
Yes,
You don't
that.
expect, right? You don't expect, I, T-Mac, I fought with my landlord for a summer, 8 months, because our air conditioning broke. So I had fans in there. You remember coming down, right?
Oh, yeah.
We had fans in there in the middle of the summer in a retail store, and people still came to see us, and they still did fittings, even though it was 85 degrees in there,
Absolutely. They were
because
sweating and they were so excited to get the information that you were providing on that track man and all that stuff. So, yeah.
right? Yep. So, every business has obstacles, stuff that happens, things. Again, personal life was challenging because you're trying to keep being a good husband, keep being a good dad, keep trying to run a business, like trying to make that $6,500 every month. You know that when you open up the door on the first of the month, your lease payment is $6,500. And what I learned was, hey, that's too high. That's
Yeah.
too much. But you had signed a 36-month lease, so you have to honor it.
Yep.
So you do things throughout the 3 year time period to make that happen. And what it led me to on the positive side was a ton of great relationships, great friendships of people that I've met during those 3 years. It was awesome to have my daughters come down there and work with me. You came down again. You came down with some of the people that you were teaching, doing club fitting, and you'd see my, one or two of my daughters in there
Oh yeah.
pretty much all the time,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah. And we never really saw him over at Silverado, if you know what I mean. It was always
Too far.
go for you, right? I mean, I saw him every once in a while, but
Yeah.
it seemed like it was kind of like a your work, but still kind of like a dad's hangout. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my point with that is it showed them that if you believe in something, dream something up, decide to do something, if you put the work in and the effort and have the plan, that's what I like. That's why I'm like not disappointed the store didn't work. But to me, it's the better life lesson for the girls, my daughters, is that if you decide to do something and you put your mind to it, you can get it done.
Yeah.
Again, the peripheral of all the rest of it, of why it didn't work, it's there's just maybe just bottom line too many obstacles. In the small business world, as soon as the inflation went up in May of 2022, like I can pinpoint it to the month, our
Yeah.
sales were going good, and then without getting into politics of it, inflation gets to a whatever a 30-year high,
Yeah.
May of 2022. The buying habits change of the golfer. They decide to buy more stuff that is used on eBay and on Amazon. They come in more for $50 golf lessons instead of $1,000 golf sets.
Yeah.
You can't give enough lessons to generate to do $6,500 in monthly rent, plus pay yourself, plus pay your vendors, you know. So the ultimate part of it is, okay, so now I've got this TrackMan, this $20,000 machine, and I literally, you know, again, there's a cycle bar 3 doors down from the store. And I keep thinking about it. I'm like, why are they not open? They're only open from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m., maybe 9 a.m. And then the girls who are doing the spin classes, they come back at like 4 p.m. and they work from like 4 to 8. But there is 8 hours a day where nobody is in that building. How are they doing it? And I'm like, some light bulb clicked during that time when I'm like, you know what? If I take TrackMan, and it's such a great tool for teaching and for playing virtual golf, and we find a space for it, and then we do turn it into a private hitting facility where, yeah, there's plenty of birdie bars and these different places out there would have that have liquor and food associated with them. But I wanted it where it was a private club. You got your 4-digit code to the front door, you booked your tee time online, you never saw anybody in the place because it was your time. When it was your time, it was your time.
Correct.
And you kept good care of it. And as far as I know, One Stop Golf Club is still operational and going well. Patrick's doing a good job with it. I think he's still doing some teaching there
Yeah, I
in West Virginia.
had 2 lessons this morning over there. Yeah, so it's in great
Isn't
shape.
that
Yeah.
crazy? Yeah. So, you know, from the kind of from the turmoil of One Stop Golf Shop to the positivity of One Stop Golf Club, the private hitting facility. And now I realize now my friend Tal Almage, he's got a pretty thriving business in Brandon, taking the same exact business model, because he was the one who helped me do the construction on it as we're doing the construction at the Wesley Chapel location. I think the light bulb in his head went, oh my goodness, we can replicate this. And I said, yeah, I know we can't, like, we got to get the first one going. And then he had the backing, the financial backing and the money and the ability to be able to do it. And you know, I'm disappointed I'm not part of that facility, but at the time I just couldn't. So he's done a great job. He's got, I think, 65 members now, and
Oh, good.
he uses FlightScope, which is a little less money than TrackMan, but the software he uses is like way better virtual golf. So my overall point is, again, sort of like, if you can do it, dream it, do it, and then I'm gonna do that model somewhere up here in the Massachusetts area. Just got to find the right, you know, the right space and go from there.
Yeah, I think it's a great business model, number one. Number two, I think taking the ideas that at least that I've seen from the ideas of having that 24-hour fitness center or something like that, you've converted that into this new business model, which I go on the Pick Time. That's the program that's used for is Pick Time. And when we go on there, you can see that there's people that will literally go there at 2 in the morning to 2 to 4, because that's their time, and this is time that they would never be able to do it. Now, people have different lifestyles, different, times of work. So it just allows people to work on their game, a game that they love at any time of hour, which I think is absolutely an amazing idea.
It's a good concept. So we're excited to do some more stuff like that up here in the future. Appreciate you asking about that, because I'm proud of it. I think it's going to be a little bit of a wave of the future, and no staff, no mess, just, you know, private hitting bay. So yeah, I know we're getting long, and I want to be, you know, I don't want to bore our listeners too much. I just, if you can, if you give me indulge me, let me wrap up with one story, if that's all right.
Please, absolutely.
I think I'm really appreciate the fact that we were able to do this. And my story is, my brother's an amazing guy. I think I've, you know, mentioned him. We've done some podcasts with him about Augusta and just kind of his industry role too. And my mom, like I said, is just, she's always been there for me too. That's part of the reason I'm up in Massachusetts this summer, is to be able to see her a little more often. But the story that I wanted to tell quickly, I think I might have mentioned it throughout other podcasts, but at least for this one, is this story of, so my dad was, again, the most humble, most proud person of his kids, of his two sons, but he was humble to the nth degree. And lived his life. I literally had a member up here, David Chalmers, came to me on probably one of my first weeks up here, And he said, he introduced himself. He goes, now, Sean, did you happen to have a, is your dad's name Mel Klotz? And Mr. Chalmers is probably in his late 60s, early 70s. I hope I don't get in trouble
Okay.
somewhere in that area. And I said, yeah, my dad's Mel Klotz. I said, well, how do you know that? He goes, I worked with your dad at New England Life Insurance Company from 1969 to 1972.
Oh,
And I'm like, what is the small world part of this thing happening up here? And he goes, your dad was the most kind, gentle, helpful. He was my mentor. He was just an amazing person. And I'm so glad that you're working here so we can talk about him. And he goes, I think I might even have met your mom because she was a secretary, or she was like one of the persons in the New England Life Insurance Company too. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So just chills going through my body. I'm like, this is so crazy. So I think that's just a cool little
oh, that's
Oakley country
amazing.
club, right? Watertown story. So my dad had a lot of health issues. I would say the last time he died when he was 71 years old in 2007. I'd say the last time he touched a club was probably around 55 or 58 years old. Like the last 13 years, he just couldn't hold the club T Mac. He just couldn't. His fingers were so bad with arthritis. You know, we tried the jumbo chamois clubs, grips and stuff, but he just couldn't hold the club, so he had no strength anyways. You know, most he ever hit it was 180 yards anyways. So he just kind of gave it up.
Okay.
So I'm going to reference people if they want to go listen to the Augusta story, please do. That Augusta podcast we had is amazing. I
Yes.
won't tell that story, but we did take him to Augusta, me and my brother, in 2004. So I talked to him on a Tuesday night in 2007, or 2007 in June. He passed away on the Thursday, 2 days later. And as with everybody's parents, typically your dad too, like, you know, super sad time. I wish I could talk to him every day. You're going to continue to find out, T Mac, that you're going to, you know, as a parent, you wish you could talk to your parents more because they were pretty smart, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, especially at times like now, you'd love a little guidance, right?
Yes.
Love a
Where's
little guy, little somebody who's walked through those
the
shadows before to
book?
kind of help you
Exactly.
guide you through. So yeah, I
Exactly.
know what you mean exactly.
So June of 2007. So I'm at Green Valley Country Club. I was there from 2004 to 2008. It's the following Father's Day, so it's July, or it's sorry, June of 2008. Playing with some members in a normal Sunday afternoon game. It's Father's Day. I guess I was playing golf because I was working. I don't know if that means I was a bad dad, but I knew I had to work anyways, whatever. So I shoot a very generic, boring 36 on the front nine. And it's just, you know, I say that without being, I'm not being arrogant at all. It's just, it was like a non-committal. People would die to shoot 36 that listened to us. They'd be very happy,
Yeah.
right? Some of our listeners. And then I start off the back nine, and it's par four. You can drive it if you can hit it over the water, probably about 260 to go over the water. Happen to hit it, catch a good one, make an eagle. Somehow make eagle, right? Driver about 12 feet, make an eagle. Birdie the next par three,
All right, we're on a
next hole
move.
par five. Yeah, next hole is par five. Happen to hit a driver and like a 5 wood on the green, another 15 footer, make a putt. Okay, now we're 5 under after 3 holes.
All right.
We go birdie birdie on 13 and 14, so now we're 7 under
Oh, we're looking
on the
at
back,
course record at this point, aren't we?
right, exactly. And basically my kind of overall point of telling the story is I've never shot 64 before in my life. The first time that I shot 64, I was able to do it again about 3 years later when I was at Silverado or Silver Oaks with Brantley and actually my buddy Ron Crump. But the first time I ever broke 68, by the way, was when I shot 64 on Father's Day, the year after my dad passed away. And if you don't want to tell me about like godly moments or something kind of like, you know, hair on the back of your neck type of thing, that was when I knew he was still with me. And it was just an
Yeah.
amazing experience. So.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think there's little hints through people's lives when they lose loved ones that there's I don't know how to say it, but yeah, it's kind of like they still walk along us, they're still
Yeah.
there, they're Maybe they whisper something subconsciously that we don't hear about and calms us. But I think you're right. I think they find time to spend with us wherever they are and whatever plane that they're in. But
Watching over us.
Final question for you here as we kind of wrap up today's podcast is, in 3 to 5 years, where do you find yourself? You know, where do you find yourself being? What are some of the goals that we're looking for in that time span?
Yeah, great question. Challenging question because of I really enjoyed my time at Oakley this summer. Mm-hmm. Right now, the plan is to come back for next summer in 2025 and kind of learn it and do it again. Because as Scott says, the first year you don't really know what you're doing. The second year you start kind of getting an idea because things are starting to slow down a little bit. You're starting to understand all that. And by the time you get to the third year, basically I should be able to run the place for him at that point, you know.
Great.
So I think as I look at it right now, you know, a little more flexibility with the personal life of what I can do. I really do want to get down and see my daughters again, you know, but they're 24 and they're 22 and they're 19. They're doing their own things now.
Living their own lives.
They don't need me to be in the same city or state or whatever. I wish I could. Right now, financially, this is definitely the best opportunity. I really like the membership up here at Oakley. It's kind of that the private club feel with a little bit of like a working man's clientele, but there's also some people that have been very, very successful in their world. I think there's going to be some type of ownership of some type of private hitting facility as well.
Okay.
I love what we're doing with the podcast, and I want to keep doing some more YouTube videos, you know, so kind of staying in the golf world, just again, sort of like we talked about throughout this session, like don't want to pigeonhole me to one specific thing, but keep spreading that word of how to get better at the game.
Correct.
And just, you know, let's keep doing what we're doing. Let's keep having a good time. And I'm not going to be apologetic that my hobby turned into my career. That's kind of the bottom line.
And it kind of goes back to the old idea. If you find something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Right. And I think, you know, that's what we're trying to go for. Right. At least for me, I enjoy what
that's
I do.
It.
And,
that's
you know, and yep. to the other point, I think with the podcast and YouTube and stuff like that, you know, let me ask you, when you first got into the PGA, did you ever think that, man, I'm going to do a podcast about golf or YouTube?
No podcast, you know? There was no podcast. You know, right? There was no Instagram 20 years ago. There's no Facebook, no YouTube. No, mm-hmm. It's got to evolve. You got to mold your, you know, kind of keep moving on, and you get stuck in that. You get stuck in that cycle of just doing the same thing every day. You're going to probably just kind of have the same results. So, no, you got to be excited and eager about it, and keep going, keep trying.
Yeah, I think if you come with that same attitude, you know, that we do with golf, with the same industry, you know, idea, you know, I want to experiment, try different things and be excited, enthusiastic about it. Good things come. I mean, and there's going to be, you know, I think the bigger thing is that we've got to be able to change and morph. And we also got to look that there's going to be a lot of different things to come to the golf industry in the future that we don't even know about or even think about at this current time. And I think you're kind of on the wave of that future with the indoor simulator idea and the concept of having the country club feel inside those indoor simulators. So, you know, I'm excited to see what that blossoms into and what the next evolution is for that.
The whole TrackMan thing. And I mean, now I'll be a little arrogant. I consider myself to be an expert in TrackMan teaching and fitting.
Mm-hmm.
And how did I get there? It just got there because I did it for 3 years for 10 hours a day, right?
Correct.
And you come down and you saw me do some fittings, and I think that you could feel pretty comfortable about doing club fittings as well now, because you, again, same thing like we do with the golf lessons 10 years ago.
Yep.
You showed interest in it. There's, you know, if we can be an expert in certain parts, and that's what we are as golf professionals. We are experts in our field,
mm-hmm.
right? People come to us for a reason.
Absolutely.
Do we do a good job? We don't do the greatest job of monetizing that because we kind of give away a lot of advice. But
that's kind of, the tradition of the game, isn't it? I mean,
my lawyer charged me $400 an hour. She wasn't upset, you know?
Yeah.
My lawyer charged me, you know, $50 for every 15 minutes of an email that might've taken her 2 minutes. And I'm not bad mouthing the lawyer. I'm just saying, as golf professionals, maybe this might be another podcast topic. We should really discuss how we can maybe grow the PGA, kind of like the apprentices, and kind of show them that, hey, there's money to be made out there. We just got to do a better job of maybe being a better role model for you guys and girls that are 20 and 25 years old and deciding to go into the corporate world, because you don't want to kind of become an assistant pro because you know you're not going to make enough money. I think that's a, let's just make that a podcast topic in the
Well,
future.
my podcast on that would be taking the PGA from a nonprofit to a profit. And I think that would be the big start right there for that conversation,
There you
especially
go. There you
for
go.
professionals.
Yeah.
So,
All right.
I want to say thank you to everybody. Thank you for listening, my Dynamic Golf listeners. I am your co-host, Tim McIlvenna. With me is my fellow co-host, Sean Klotz. Sean?
Hey, really, really good session there. Hope we didn't bore too many people. Gave some good stories, and look forward to the next one. We got the historian for the Oakley Country Club coming up here, Dan Mee, in the next podcast. So that'll be a great one for our listeners.
And what's he a historian of? He's the country club and
The basically like a board of directors position where you're literally the historian of the club,
wow.
and he's been, he's excited to share. He doesn't want to keep this stuff in a box. He wants to tell the people of the story of how this became Oakley Country Club with the Donald Ross influence.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about a historian, and I've got a history degree. We learn all this stuff from the past, and we want to bring it back to the future and let people know that, hey, this is knowledge of keeping to remember.
That's
So, all right. Well,
it.
thank you so much, and we look forward to the next podcast. Thank you.